When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 149.
On today's show, we talk about ancient textiles and textile production.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. Rachel, how's it going?
Pretty good.
We are still in North Carolina, for those that care, for some reason.
Oh, we are always traveling, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what are we talking about today?
Yeah, so
it's a themed episode, right?
It is a themed episode. This episode is going to be all about textiles in the news.
Freaking knitters.
I know. Well, it's not all knitting. Actually, most of this is not knitting at all. This is weaving because the oldest textiles are all woven textiles.
I mean, isn't weaving just like knitting with a machine? It's kind of stuff together. And
oh, no, not at all.
Knitting's loops. I get it.
Yeah. Knitting is loops and it's very stretchy. And weaving is like... Like, you know, when you were a kid and you would like have like a whole line of lines of yarn and then you'd lift them up and then interlock, go in the other direction.
No, I
did you never
do
like crafts like that?
Who had a loom as a kid? Seriously.
I don't know. It's a pretty common like 80s kid craft to do, I think.
You were either in a fancy school or you were a kid in the 1600s.
No. Okay.
One of those two things happened.
Anyway, no, weaving is like interlocking threads or yarns woven together. So... they're very, very different techniques. But the reason that we decided to do this themed episode is because there was a couple articles that came out in the last couple months about textiles, and we just thought it would be fun to kind of group them all in together. So segment one is about an article from Peru, and the title is Peru, Skeletal Remains of 25 People Found at Chanchan Archaeological Site.
And it's Chanchan, not Chanchan?
Okay, so I have been there. So that was the other reason why we decided to... Well, I decided to talk about this article is because this is a place that I've been and I remember it being pronounced Chanchan.
Okay.
So Chanchan is in Peru. It's right near the town of Trujillo in Trujillo province. Of course, Trujillo is the biggest town on the north coast of Peru, basically. Okay. Very, very close to the ocean. This site is really interesting for a lot of different reasons. And then this burial area that they found is also super interesting because it's very unusual, and it's just got an unusual grouping of people mm-hmm. in it. It's located on a raised area of the Utsan, the Great Chimú Walled Complex, and that is part of the like main city complex of Chanchan.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Chimú Empire a little bit after we talk about the article.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, give us some context.
Because like honestly, this article doesn't really have a whole lot of substance to it yet because this was just discovered.
Yeah.
They just found these burials. They don't really know what's going on. But there were 25 burials. Most of them are women under 30, and they were buried with objects related to textile activities, whatever that might mean. There's also a couple children and a couple teenagers. So this is kind of an unusual composition for like a burial area.
Mm-hmm.
And to be buried specifically with the things you need to make textiles is really interesting.
Yeah.
They also found about 70 vessels and objects used in textile work. So... they don't really know what's going on here, and they need to do a lot more research to figure out if all these burials were buried at the same time. Are they from one single incident where everybody died together for some crazy reason?
Or were killed together.
Or were killed together. Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why they could all be buried together like this, and I think a lot more research needs to be done to figure out why. But the interesting and cool thing is that they all have the textile connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting too. Anytime you hear about burials where people are buried with something, especially a specialized object, it's hard to imagine how important and significant that was, because my brain immediately thinks, well, you know, it was really hard to make stuff back then because they didn't have Amazon and you couldn't just like get a new one.
Right.
You had to actually make it or trade for it or buy it. I mean, obviously they had an economy, but those kinds of things weren't all that hard. So to me, it makes it sound like it's a really special object, not just because it's something you used every day, but because it's something that was hard to come by, mm-hmm. because it took some effort to make it. But then I'm like, when you just live in that world where everything is hard to come by and you have to work to do everything, is it really work? Or is it just like, yeah, I know it's going to take me a week to get another one of these, but that's cool.
Right.
You know?
And like, speaking of living in a time where everything is hard.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Chan Chan and what and where it was a little bit. It's the capital of the Chimu Empire, it was the capital of the Chimu Empire, and it was the capital from like 900 to around 1470. And that 1470 date is so specific because they were defeated by the Inca in the 1470 and incorporated into the Inca Empire. And we know for sure because of writings from the time of the Spanish, you know, conquistadors. They came another, 50 or 80 years later or something like that. So they have pretty solid knowledge on when this happened.
Yeah, isn't it crazy? Like, anytime we talk about Europe, the Romans come up. But I feel like if you talk about Peru, like the Inca up.
It's the Spanish.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the Spanish, of course.
And then the Spanish.
But before the Spanish even got there, there were plenty of empires doing conquering.
Yeah. So. Well, Inca, like, were particularly known for conquering. Like, they were very similar to Romans in the way that they would absorb a group that they conquered into their society. And what they did with the Chimu, which was really interesting, is that they took all the artisans, because that's what Chimu was kind of known for, was their beautiful artwork. And they sent them all to, I think, to Machu Picchu, which was the capital at that point, or maybe Cusco. But they got sent to where the Incan capital and the Incan rich people were, so they could get absorbed into those groups and start, you know, peddling their wares to the rich Incans.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, and the cool thing is this city wasn't like super small. I mean, probably small by today's standards, but as a coastal city, maybe not. I mean, they had 40,000 to 60,000 people, and it took up an area of about 9 square miles. Yeah. So that's pretty dense, actually.
It's huge, and most of it is still there. And like, you can, not all of it is open to the public, but like, when you're driving down the road in between, Huanchaco is the name of the city that I stayed at when I was working in Peru, and Trujillo. So there's like this coastal highway that kind of like connects between the two. And you're just like driving next to ruins for part of that road. It's totally crazy. So a lot of it is still there. But the really different part about the city is that it's made up almost entirely of adobe structures rather than stone, which is what you normally think of when you think of South American ancient cities. But it's adobe. And it is the largest adobe city in the Americas.
Nice.
It's located in a desert, and this is where I was saying about the hard places to live. It's located in a desert, and at the time that it was thriving, there was a huge lack of water in the area. And this is partly due to crust movement. Over time, the water table was just like lowering on this people, on these people. Like, it was just getting lower and lower every year. The people didn't understand what the heck was going on, but they just kept pivoting to try and accommodate the lowering table level. They developed a super sophisticated canal system to divert water from the nearby Chicama River. That only really worked until around 1300, and then the water table just got too low and the river was not producing enough water, and they just abandoned it completely, the whole canal system. And then because they had to abandon the canal system, they also basically abandoned agriculture in general, like on a large scale. And they started relying on resources from the sea almost exclusively.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff going on, like weather-wise, in this part of the world. That you have El Nino and La Nina weather events that would come in every so often, and they were starting to get worse in that time period too. So like, there's just a lot of things that are starting to build and be problems for these people. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why they were weak enough in the 1400s for the Incas to be able to defeat them. Who knows?
Yeah, and it's crazy with, you know, we always say, and in fact, part of the Archaeology Podcast Network is learning about the past. And, you know, sometimes we say in order to, you know, dictate our future, you study the past and you learn from the mistakes of the past. But the reality is we just don't do that. So, or we use advanced technology to overcome problems in the past. Like, you know, by 1300, they were already having problems with their water table.
Yeah.
And then they were conquered by the Inca, and the Inca are like, you know, whatever, we got the sea and we'll do that. And then later on, they were conquered, or well, mostly by Pizarro in this area.
Yeah.
And Pizarro, I can't remember, it was probably late 1500s, something like that.
1530-ish, I think.
Yeah, somewhere
yeah.
around there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he established Trujillo, but he established the city that became Trujillo there,
and
which pushed out Chan Chan, basically.
Yeah, anybody who was still living in in Chan Chan at
Chan
that
Chan,
point.
Sorry, Chan Chan. Chan Chan, Chan Chan.
Yeah, if whatever, say however you want to.
So, anyway, it fell into, you know, disuse a little bit as the new city kind of took over and just got bigger. But now there's like a huge city there.
Yeah, Trujillo is huge.
And they still more than likely have water problems, but they've just found ways to get water deeper or truck it in, you know, through the canals or do something. So,
yep.
But crazy.
Yeah, well, when the city was thriving, most of the residents of the city were super wealthy. I think there were a lot of like small villages and stuff outside of the city that had like your sort of everyday working people. And then the city itself, it was super wealthy, privileged elite. And that included the craftsmen and priests and people of those classes.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to our burial story here, it might seem weird to think of a bunch of weavers being buried in like this really important and special complex. But from what we know about the Chimu people and Chan Chan, the city, it seems like the people there really valued their craftsmen and they were an upper class group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how they all got buried there together, they're all of roughly the same age. Like, who knows?
Yeah.
That's
don't know what's going on.
Those
there.
Are more questions that we may not ever be able to answer. Anyway, just a couple more things about Chan Chan itself. It's a really, really cool site to see. And as I said, I've seen it in person. And it's just so neat to see the adobe features and structures all around it.
Mm-hmm.
They have these beautiful carvings of all these different animals and figures, a lot of marine figures, because clearly by the end they were relying on the sea to provide most of their resources. And it's just a really, really cool, cool area to see. However, like I mentioned, the El Nino factor is really like taking a toll on the city.
Yeah.
So, you know, 1,000 years ago when water was their problem, they didn't have enough of it. Well, now water is a big problem. And ironically, it's because there's too much of it. It's because it's raining too much.
Yeah.
So the rain are caused by the more frequent El Nino events. And I mean, as anybody who works with adobe structures knows, rain is kind of like the killer of it. It melts them away over time. So the adobe structures were great when this was a desert and it had almost no water. That was the perfect medium for a structure. But now, 1,000 years later, there's too much rain and it's just like melting away these structures.
So what you're saying is before California was invented and hipsters and hippies, that they invented biodegradable, sustainable structures well before anybody ever thought about
it. Yeah, totally.
They're being reclaimed by the earth
they
now.
They are. They're totally being reclaimed. It's nice. It's so sad though. And there's some talk about like putting structures up over the top of everything to preserve it. But like, I think a lot of it is just like your basic everyday walls. And it's like, is there a point in preserving just a wall? Maybe the really pretty stuff with the decoration and the carvings, but I don't know. And it's 9 square miles too. I mean, it's huge. So that just, I'm not really sure how they're going to preserve that. Doesn't seem like it's really possible.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right. Well, next we're going to talk about Turkey. But not white meat and dark meat. We're going to talk about the always hard to pronounce Çatalhöyük in Turkey. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 149 of the Archaeology Show. And again, we're talking about Çatalhöyük in Turkey, and that is how you pronounce it. It's got a whole bunch of, it's got a weird C with a dangly bit on it and some other things, and it's just all crazy. But
it's another language, so.
I mean, it's not wrong, but anyway. Yeah. All right, so as many as, this is a little hard to wrap your head around, as many as 10,000 people lived in Çatalhöyük around 8,000 to 9,000 years ago.
So many people for,
it's so long
for
ago.
For 8,000 people. Yeah. 8,000 years ago. That's crazy. It's so many people.
Yeah. I mean, we always are like, you know, savages in the prehistoric. They didn't know anything, but they had like legit cities and were doing things.
Yeah.
You know, eight to 10,000 years ago in that area.
Yeah. Like in a city that big, people, there are probably people that you didn't know. You know what I mean? Like you think of these old villages as like everybody was related. Everybody had a relationship. Everybody knew everybody. It was like you're all up in your business kind of a relationship, but not in a city like this. Not,
yeah,
not with that many people.
Well, it's been excavated over the years quite a few times, actually. Lots of excavations, lots of activity there. Mm-hmm. I, in fact, know a few people that have actually worked there, spent a lot of time there. There's just ongoing field seasons for many decades at Çatalhöyük. So during a 1962 excavation, some pieces of cloth were found, and the material, or the type of material it is, has been debated. So they couldn't tell in the 60s exactly what that was.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they made assumptions like you normally do because, like, you know, old cloth, people just take guesses that it's either wool or linen, right? Mm-hmm. That's just what they were guessing. But there was no, like, actual scientific evidence of what it was.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that does tell you, though, is that there was, you know, definitely weaving and things going on 8,000 to 9,000 years ago.
They for sure knew
in this
that.
Area. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of drama around this excavation, too. Originally, this excavation or period of excavation started in the 50s by James Mellart, and Turkish authorities later expelled him from the country because he was allegedly involved in the black market sale of archaeological artifacts.
Real stand-up dude there.
Yeah.
Doing, making a good name for archaeologists.
I'm guessing his prime customer was the British Museum, but you didn't hear that from me.
Oh, my God. So. You know. I feel like you're like a little bit mad at the British Museum.
I mean, everybody's a little mad at the British Museum.
But you like have a lot of comments to make about like them stealing artifacts.
They didn't really steal them. It was the time, right?
I know.
People would give them, sell them.
They didn't care about provenance at all.
They really didn't. Yeah. The same people that ran the museum were the same types of people in the same era that just like didn't see the people whose artifacts they were taking as like real people.
Yeah. Like they didn't matter in this decision because they didn't find it. So therefore they didn't matter.
I mean, the fine people at the British Museum now obviously don't feel that way, but they're stuck with this legacy.
Yeah.
And they're dealing with it. So
yeah, for sure.
We should get somebody on from the British Museum to talk about that.
We should. Yeah.
If you're listening, contact us. Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. If you want to send us hate mail, Tristan at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Or you can send a tweet to the Life in Ruins podcast.
Oh my God. Wow.
I know. Deflection.
Deflecting to everybody right now.
So Ian Hodder is somebody that if you're an archaeologist and you went to school, you know who Ian Hodder is.
Yeah.
He's a very famous archaeologist, wrote a lot of books, had a lot of theories. And he began excavations at Çatalhöyük with his team in 1993 when he worked for Stanford University. And that ran all the way until 2017.
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was totally involved for that entire time,
probably
but
not.
There was definitely like excavations that were begun by him that went all the way until that time period. And some of the later excavations turned up more cloth. And this time, being in the 2000s and having better technology and really more interest in textile to begin with. I think in the 60s when it was first discovered, there just like wasn't a whole lot of interest in what the fiber was, how they were making it. It was more just like checking the box. Great, they had textile. Let's move on. But now there are people that are interested in figuring out exactly what that stuff was. And when they found more cloth, textile expert Bender Jorgensen was invited to study the pieces of cloth and figure out what this material is.
Like his name was legit Bender?
Her name was, yes.
Oh, her name is Bender. I didn't know if a Bender was a him or a he. So. But I said he because Bender, obviously, from Futurama.
From Futurama, I know. When I was reading her name, I was like, that's a cool name.
That's pretty neat.
Anyway, well, the Bender is kind of a jerk, so maybe it's not a cool name.
Yeah, so cool name, but...
Yeah. Anyway, so people for the last 50 years, like I said earlier, had just kind of assumed that this fiber was wool or linen, and nobody really thought about more about what it could be. They overlooked other options. They just weren't really that interested. So Bender Jorgensen consulted with an archaeobotanist, and they together tested the fibers to try and figure out what they are. And it was found to be bast fiber from oak, willow, or linden trees.
What is bast?
Yeah, so bast is the name for that like fibrous substance that's found between the bark on the outside of a tree and the woody like inside part.
When you pull bark off and you see that like spiderwebby fiber?
Yeah, that stuff, yeah. Huh. And it's very, very different. It's in all like trees and woody species, right? Mm-hmm. But it's very, very different depending on what species you're talking about. And actually, technically, linen, hemp, and jute, which are all other common early fibers, are also from the bast family. Same idea. It's that pulling that bark away and getting to that fibrous inside bit. But so oak, willow, and linden trees are all natural to the Çatalhöyük area. So that just shows that people are using the resources that they have nearby, and they figure out how to use them in a way to make the things that they need to make without trying to trade or import from elsewhere. And people always want to talk about trade and what cool trade things past cultures were doing, because that is always interesting too, is to see who they're trading with and where it was coming from. But I also think it's like really interesting to see how they just take a look at their own landscape and figure out how to use the materials that they have present right there and usable.
I just wonder how that idea even develops, right? Like you have to have a knowledge, I think, of, well, spinning and weaving in order to even think, where could I get other fibers? Because my normal source, or maybe I'm looking for something different right now, but what I was using before is either not available or I'm looking for something stronger. Like maybe these textiles were used as my image in my head is like a burlap sack or something like that.
It was pretty rough. A lot of it was. Yeah.
So it's like, but what are you doing that you're thinking you need something like that? And you're like, oh, this might work. It's just crazy to me that they would think that.
It is crazy. And it seems to have been independently developed around the world, which we'll actually talk about that a little bit more in segment three. But the fact that they figured out that they could use this fiber as something to weave into cloth is just a really interesting development that happened multiple times around the world. And we know that this particular type of bast was used for thousands of years for rope, too. So like that kind of information we already had. But rope is so rough that people just didn't consider it. Scientists and archaeologists didn't really consider it as an option for clothing, because the material that you use to make rope is usually very different from the material that you use to make clothing, you know. But it turns out that with this type of bast, you could rip those fibrous inside bits out of the tree, and then all you have to do is separate those fibers, and they're basically ready to start weaving with, because they're very long and very thin. And you can separate them into groups of the fibers, or you can even separate them all the way down to the individual pieces. And that's how you would get the finer and softer material. And that material, you could make it even softer by processing it with water too. Just like just washing it basically would make it softer.
Yeah.
And that's true of linen fiber today. If anybody has ever bought like linen sheets or a linen shirt, the more times you wash it, the softer it gets. It's just how that kind of fiber, bast fiber, reacts to water and washing. It just gets softer with time.
Nice.
So there's one bit of corroborating evidence for why we know that these that this material, the cloth that they found, is made from a different kind of bast from the oak trees. And that is because there is zero archaeological evidence for flax seeds anywhere in the valley where Chatelhaic is located. So you have to have flax seeds in order to grow the flax plant so that you can process the fibers out of it that become linen. You have to have that. So there is no flax seeds anywhere, which means that they did not grow linen. They were just looking at their natural environment and their natural resources and taking advantage of what they had there, which I just love that. It's so cool. I'm going to go peel some bark off outside and see what I find.
Yeah, you do that. We'll see how this RV park takes to that.
I know, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to learn a little bit more about this technology and bast and making things like that. Because I don't even know how to talk about the segue because I know so little about this. So back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 149 of the Archaeology Show. And in this segment, we are going to kind of go even deeper into into bast and fibers and
sounds fun
what you use to weave. I know you are so like not interested in this. You are one of those archaeologists from the 60s who doesn't care about what fiber is used to make cloth.
I would legit sell this at this RV park. I'm kidding. Obviously no, I'm interested from a technology standpoint. Yeah. It fascinates me the things people came up with just to survive and clothe themselves and do things, and it was really born out of a lot of necessity.
It was you know?
Sure. And then when we ended up with city states and royal elite, then people were, you know, essentially commanded to come up with, you know, fancier and fancier things, and that kind of thing drives innovation.
It did. It totally drove innovation, and I just love seeing it from a crafter perspective and a maker perspective. One of the things I love about making things myself with my own hands is that you do feel like this connection both to people in the past and how they made things, but also to like the natural landscape too. I'm not even joking about going and pulling bark off of a tree and seeing if I can find some bast to weave into something. I'll try it just to see how it works and what it looks like. It's
maybe we just go do that at like your sister's house or something. Not like here.
We're not going to do it like right here, but I am intrigued by figuring out that process. And there's some fibers that are way easier to do it with. Like bamboo is so much easier to pull those fibrous bits out of. So anyway, but this third article is called Unraveling the Secrets of Bronze Age Thread. Textile reveals highly advanced and complex process used 3,800 years ago. And this is talking about bast again, because again, it's this huge category that includes linen and flax, jute, all those different like plant-based fibers. And the question is like, you take this fibrous bit between the bark and the wood, and how in the heck do you turn that into something, into fiber that can be woven or twisted into rope?
And I feel like we almost need to define rope, although there is no solid definition of rope, because what takes something from being just like a twisted fiber, like yarn or something, or a thread, and calling it rope? Like, it's not a certain size. We have really small rope. We have big rope.
Yeah.
You know, rope seems to be twisted together smaller ropes in a lot of cases, but that's just twisted together smaller fibers.
Yeah. So the spinning process for a fiber, you basically twist one strand in one direction, and then you twist all the small strands, all these skinny strands in one direction, however many you need to ply together, and then you ply them together in the other direction. That's how you get S-twist and Z-twist, they're called. They're going the two different directions, and you do one all in one direction, the smaller ones, then you twist them all together in the other direction, basically. And that's how you get yarn. And I imagine rope is a very similar process, although I talk about how much I love like textiles and yarn and stuff, but I really have done no research on rope. I don't know like anything about the composition or how it's made at all. There's a hole. I need to go down that rabbit hole someday and figure it out.
I mean, kind of as a side note, we're talking about making pasta. We made pasta at your sister's house a couple weeks ago, and we're talking about making it again. I'm thinking while the pasta's still wet, you'd like weave or knit some of that together, and we make a new kind of pasta. Like these little squares, little sample squares of like woven pasta.
Like make ravioli with little like woven tops.
Well, I don't know about ravioli because the filling would come out.
But it'd look real pretty.
It would look real pretty. Unless you made like a jalapeno ravioli or something. Uh-huh. Like, oh my God, I've got it.
Oh my God.
Jalapeno popper ravioli. So you stuff the ravioli with cream cheese.
And jalapenos.
The jalapeno with cream cheese.
Okay.
And then you put that inside the ravioli cage.
Okay. And then you deep fry it.
And then you deep fry it.
Oh my God. That sounds amazing.
So this podcast just ended because we legit have to go find jalapeno popper ravioli cages.
Yes, we need to go do that. It's going to take 4.5 hours to do all of that before we can eat like four. Anyway, okay. Wow, tangent. So where were we?
Rope.
Rope. So bast is super flexible, but it is still part of a plant. It's like a little bit woody, and then depending on the species, it can be quite rough. The fibers themselves are pretty long. So that's nice that they're super long pieces depending on how big of a chunk of tree you're working off of, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of reminds me of like the fine silk in corn, you know, between the husk and the corn itself, the like grouping of corn silk that you can pull out.
I mean, has anybody ever woven that?
I don't know. It's very thin and breakable, so I don't know how well it would work.
Well, yeah, so are some other fibers, but we string them together.
You put them together and they work. Yeah, I don't know. Try some corn silk.
I mean, an individual strand of like sheep's hair breaks pretty easy.
Yeah, they're very short pieces.
But when you put them all together.
Yeah. Well, the bast is, it looks similar to that. Like you're peeling it out like you would from a corn husk, right? And then, so you can leave it in a larger chunk of a whole bunch of those fibers together, or you can separate it down into like the individual piece. And the finer you separate it, the fewer strands of each fiber you have together, the finer the piece of clothing or rope or whatever you're doing is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, the cloth is going to be the finest pieces of that, like separated down to the fewest number of those fibers held together. So for weaving, you need like long connected lengths of fiber. And that's what this article is really getting at, was how did they connect those fibers together? Because this kind of fiber is not really conducive to spinning, like on a spinning wheel, like you would think. That was the assumption for a long time, is that they just popped it on a spinning wheel, a drop spindle. And we found evidence of those spindle whorls and stuff like that on different archaeological sites from like long ago. Like there's been a lot of evidence of that. But this article is showing that that's how those wool fibers were spun. Because there's often wool in conjunction with linen on a lot of older sites.
Right.
And those spindles wouldn't necessarily have been used to process the linen, because it just wouldn't really work for it. The fibers are much longer, and spinning takes shorter sections and intermingles them together into one spun strand, but there's no specific join point. It becomes one continuous super long thread until you end it, basically.
Yeah.
So what they looked for in these early textiles, these early Bronze Age textiles from Britain, was they were looking to see what the join points looked like in the fabric so they could see how it was made, basically. And what they found was that they were spliced rather than spun and like spun together, right? And now, so that's really interesting, because splicing has previously been identified in pre-dynastic Egyptian and Neolithic Swiss textiles. So these are totally different places, totally different time periods, who have figured out the same way to connect these different fibers together into one continuous thread to make their clothing or fabric or whatever they needed to make.
When you take, I've seen you knit a few times in my life.
A little bit.
Like every day.
I might be knitting right now. You don't know.
No, right? But when you end a ball of yarn and you're connecting it with another, and you, in some of those, you put them together and then you rub it on your pant leg to kind of bring them together. What is that called?
That's called splicing.
Is that splicing?
Yeah. So that's a technique called spit splicing. Although most people just use water these days, but like back in the day, I think you just like pop the yarn ends into your mouth and get them all wet with spit.
Yeah.
But it takes the moisture and then heat to make the fiber stick together. And that's why you're rolling it on something. On my jeans are perfect for it.
Yeah.
You just roll it right on your pants leg to connect it. But it's the same idea with these fibers. You can see where they were like basically a kind of a J hook on the end, on each end, and then sort of hooked together. And you can see the evidence of that in the pieces of cloth themselves, that that's how they were hooked together.
Right.
So this very specific join point is called a splice, and it's not made by spinning. I'm joining together spun yarn by doing that. But these are short sections. There's a picture in this article where you can see that that join point is like very quickly happening. So they're clearly joining in like long fibers often using this method, like as they go.
I was trying to figure out like why we care about all this. What is the difference here? I didn't realize. I thought they were just doing what you do, which is taking something that was already spun, they run out of it and they connect it to something else. But no, they're kind of like making it as they go.
It's like expedient, right? Like they can just pull these fibers out of the bark from the tree nearby and then just like start doing it. They can just start doing it right there and join as they go. They don't have this intermediate spinning step.
Right. Crazy.
But the interesting part, the other interesting part is that it seems like it would be faster, but it's actually like a slower method to stop and have to join each of these sections as you go, because the fiber is only so long. It's as long as the tree is, you know, so you can get some pretty long lengths, but it's, you're still going to run out fairly quickly. You need to keep joining. So it's, the method itself is slower and it's a simpler method too, because obviously it takes no extra technology or equipment to do it. You just join it by hand and keep on going, right? So it seems logical that it would predate spinning and it would be done, it developed independently around the world in different places at different times. It's very simple. You just bloop, join them together and keep on going.
Yeah.
And just to touch on spinning like really, really quickly, the spinning technology was developed later in the development of a society, and it was usually once they got into their sailing phase, if they did, because sails require like vast amounts of fabric and you need to be able to make them quickly, and they need to be like pretty good quality too in order to like handle all of the wind and what is needed for from a sail,
and probably of a construction type that allows you to repair it while at sea.
Weaving is very, very conducive to quick repair. You can do that really easily. So yeah, spinning probably developed once they needed to make huge amounts of cloth, and it was faster. It's an extra step, but it's an extra step that speeds up the overall process significantly. So it's really interesting because that progression from splicing to spinning, specifically with plant-based fibers. Wool is a different thing entirely, but plant-based bast fibers, that splicing to spinning progression happened at different places around the world. And that's kind of what this article is saying. They found it in Britain. They found it in Egypt and Neolithic areas around the world. So it's kind of cool that they independently developed this and then it sort of progresses the same for everybody.
The thing I like about that is when you're thinking about, and I know archaeologists shouldn't talk about aliens, but I'm talking about aliens.
Poppers and aliens all in one episode. Right?
When you're thinking about life on other worlds, you know, and how that may have developed and what that life might look like. Yeah, the biology of that life might be different because of the environment they grew up in or were developed in. But chances are it's going to be, you know, something similar to life on this earth, not necessarily humans, but something similar. But technologies too. Like when you see that something was independently developed by different societies around the world in basically the same way, and even the technological progression of that development started one way and went to another way and then another way, and pretty much just with no communication between them. I mean, today's day and age, somebody invents something, it's immediately copied in China and then sold across the world, right? But, you know, that's not what we're talking about. There's no communication, no observation, nothing whatsoever, no contact between the societies, and yet they come up with the same ways of doing something. And I'm like, well, there are beings spinning plant fibers and weaving plant fibers and splicing plant fibers across the entire universe right now. And that's super cool.
Yeah. No, it is. It's when you think about that broader innovation that happens by any species with enough brain power that and enough motivation to innovate like that, and then of course you're going to see all that kind of that happen everywhere. I mean, Chattahoochee was what, 8,000-9,000 years ago, and they were, you know, they have cloth out of bast, and then also this group in Britain that's almost 4,000 years ago. I mean, there's a 4,000 year spread there and a huge geographical difference too, and yet this basically the same thing happened in the two places, different materials because it was local to their own area, but the same process. Very cool.
Yeah. Pretty cool. All right. Well, I think that's it, eh?
Yeah, I think so. That's,
all right.
That's your textile check-in for the year. I probably won't subject you and the listeners to textile stuff unless a whole slew of articles come out again.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.